Before hearing the sentence, it helps to understand how this case came before the court. In January 2024, a young woman reported being sexually assaulted at a private residence in Melbourne's Inner East. The allegations related to events that occurred late at night after a social gathering inside a bedroom where the complainant believed she was alone. The prosecution case was that Tom Silvani entered the room, deliberately misled the complainant as to who he was, and carried out sexual acts without consent. The court later heard that, in the days following the incident, steps were taken to obscure what had occurred, including attempts to alter records and shape a false timeline. Silvani was charged later that year. For much of the legal process, strict suppression orders prevented his identification or any reporting of his family background. Those orders were eventually lifted, and the matter proceeded to trial in the Victorian County Court. At trial, the defense denied the allegations and challenged the complainant's account. The jury ultimately rejected that version of events. In December, Silvani was found guilty on 2 counts of rape. What follows is the court's final response to those verdicts, the sentencing remarks delivered in open court. There is no commentary, no interpretation, and no embellishment. Just the words of the judge, explaining how the law assessed the offending, the harm caused, and the punishment imposed.
The offence of rape is part of the standard sentence scheme and carries a standard sentence of 10 years imprisonment. I note the prosecution does not make an application for discretionary sex offender registration. You have no previous or subsequent criminal histories and you have no matters outstanding. The jury verdicts are based on the following facts. On 13 January 2024, you hosted your childhood friend Anthony LaGiudice for an afternoon of summer drinking. You were at your parents' house with your girlfriend Alana Iaconis. The three of you were drinking steadily, but it is not suggested that alcohol was a factor in your offending. It appears that you ordered pizzas and then a couple came over after dinner for a couple of hours. Later in the night, Anthony and Alana both made contact with the victim of your offending, Samantha Taylor. Ms. Taylor was a friend of Ms. Iaconis and had socialised with you from time to time. In other words, although you may not have been close friends, she was known to you. Ms. Taylor had previously engaged in a casual sexual relationship with Anthony. Ms. Taylor arrived after midnight as she had attended an earlier social engagement. When she arrived, you three, the others had left, were on the couch downstairs talking. She joined your group on the couch for a few minutes before she and Alana moved upstairs. Ms. Taylor gave evidence that after you and Anthony moved upstairs, you showed Samantha around briefly and then asked her for and gave her a hug. Ms. Taylor and Mr. LaGiudice went to a spare bedroom next to yours where they engaged in consensual sexual activity. After a period of time, Mr. LaGiudice received a text from his parents to come home. He left, indicating to Ms. Taylor that he was going to get an Uber to his family home. After he left the bedroom, Mr. LaGiudice entered your bedroom and woke you. He asked you to open the front gate so that he could move his car onto the street for easy collection in the morning. You went downstairs and opened the gate. Once Mr. LaGiudice had gone, you entered the doorway of the spare bedroom and spoke to Ms. Taylor, telling her that Mr. LaGiudice's Uber had been cancelled and that he would return upstairs in a few minutes. A short while later, you quickly entered the bedroom and closed the door. The room was fully dark. You got into bed behind Ms. Taylor, spooning her. You reached your hand over her body and penetrated her vagina with your fingers. That is charge one, the charge of rape. Ms. Taylor stated that she had expected Anthony to return to the room. However, suspecting something was wrong, Ms. Taylor wriggled away to prevent the penetration from continuing. She tried to engage you in small talk so she could hear your voice. She challenged you to illuminate your face with your phone torch. She challenged your identity, asking if it was Anthony. You replied with words to the effect, "Why wouldn't it be Anthony?" In the midst of these challenges, You placed Ms. Taylor over your torso and again penetrated her vagina with your fingers. She kept saying stop, but you continued. She continued to ask if it was Anthony. You restrained her by holding her hands with your other hand. That is charge two of rape. Ms. Taylor then stated in evidence that her brain clicked and she realised it was not Anthony. She broke her hand free and touched your hair. As depicted in Exhibit Q, your hair was considerably longer than Anthony's. Ms. Taylor stated, "Stop, Tom, I know it's you." You got up and quickly left the room. When you opened the door, Ms. Taylor further recognised you by the silhouette of your longer hair as you left through the doorway. You returned to the room a few minutes later under the guise that you had heard a noise and were checking if anything was wrong. Ms. Taylor again challenged you, stating, "I know it was you in here." Ms. Taylor texted Mr. LaGiudice, who replied that he was at home. Ms. Taylor booked an Uber. Before she left, you again asked her for a hug. She then left the house. The following morning, Ms. Taylor texted Alana, stating that you had assaulted her. You denied any wrongdoing. You desperately tried to call Mr. LaGiudice, but he initially did not answer your calls. Over the next 24 hours, you told him not to communicate with or respond to Ms. Taylor, and you acted as gatekeeper to his communications with Ms. Iaconis, instructing him to variously state that he returned to Samantha's bedroom, that his Uber left after Samantha had already departed, and that he waited in another room until his Uber arrived. On 15 January, you received and altered Mr. LaGiudice's Uber receipt to falsely show that he had left after Ms. Taylor. On 22 January, Ms. Taylor formally reported the matter to police. On 25 January 2024, Ms. Taylor called you in a recorded pretext call. You told her that Anthony said he went back in, that you had seen the Uber receipt and, quote, "it all matched up," close quote. And using these lies, you repeatedly suggested to Ms. Taylor that she should not pursue this matter further. You were charged by police on 14 June 2024 and remained on bail until you were remanded in custody after the jury verdict on 5 December 2025. You have now spent 12 days on remand, excluding today, by way of pre-sentence detention, and I will reckon this as already served. Standard sentence principles. I now turn to a consideration of the standard sentencing scheme. The scheme provides for a standard sentence for the two charges of rape. The standard sentence for each charge is 10 years imprisonment. All things being equal, I must set a minimum term of not less than 60% of the head sentence unless I consider it is not in the interests of justice to do so. The standard sentence takes account only of the objective factors affecting the seriousness of the offence in question and is marked as the middle range of seriousness for that offence. Objective factors exclude consideration of matters personal to you as an offender or as belonging to a class of offenders. Rather, it is determined wholly by reference to the nature of the offending. I may only consider other standard sentencing cases when I'm looking at comparators for sentencing purposes. In determining the appropriate sentence for your offending, I must take into account the standard sentence as one of the relevant sentencing factors. In this way, it is an additional factor to consider in the sentencing process. This does not limit the matters which I must or may take into account in determining the appropriate sentence, nor is it intended to affect what is known as the instinctive synthesis process. The standard sentencing scheme may be considered as a guidepost in the sentencing consideration. However, it is neither determinative nor a starting point from which I must simply remain, go up or go down in my sentencing consideration. I turn now to a consideration of the objective gravity of your offending and an assessment of your moral culpability. The objective seriousness of the crime of rape can be measured by having regard to three statutory considerations. First, the offence carries a maximum penalty of 25 years imprisonment. Second, rape is a Category 1 offence that requires a sentence of imprisonment to be imposed, and that is not challenged here. Finally, in this respect, as I've already noted, rape is a standard sentencing offence. Individually and in combination, these factors underline the fact that although it may be committed in diverse circumstances, an offence of rape must be met by a stern jail sentence. In my view, the following factors inform the seriousness of your offending. First, although your crimes arose from an opportunity that you could not have envisaged, once the opportunity had arisen, your crimes were marked by planning, cunning and strategy in order to deceive Ms. Taylor. This included setting up the deception involved in telling Ms. Taylor that Mr. LaGiudice's Uber had been cancelled and that he would be returning to the room. Second, the first rape was committed by deception, by you pretending to be Mr. LaGiudice. This crime was relatively brief, as Ms. Taylor was able to wriggle away from your hand. Following this, Ms. Taylor challenged you. You committed the second charge of rape over her protests. She was clearly and repeatedly saying, "Stop." I take into account that you held her hands until she broke your grip whilst you committed the second act. Then your attempts at deception and deflection continued for over a week after the offending. You tried to encourage your childhood friend, Anthony, to take responsibility for your actions. You dishonestly altered a document to further this deception. And then you continued to lie to Ms. Taylor and use those lies in an effort to both undermine her belief in what you had done and to persuade her not to pursue the matter further. Your conduct towards Samantha was egregious. Your conduct towards Anthony, who had been a lifelong friend, in your own self-interest, was utterly appalling and shameful. The law in Victoria is very clear. The various forms of penetration constituting rape are not to be distinguished, and digital rape cannot be treated as less serious than penile rape. See cases, and I refer to various authorities. Digital penetration is, however, absent the risks of STI and pregnancy for what that is worth. Both crimes in your offending were committed in a period of minutes. Although they were committed close together, the acts of rape must be viewed separately. One was committed under deception and the other over Ms. Taylor's protest with you restraining her hands. You have not shown any remorse. You must not and shall not be punished for running a trial. But the factors which usually mitigate a sentence on a guilty plea have no application here. The crime of rape is an intensely personal one. The violence of rape is inherent. The fact that no injuries were sustained should not be allowed to overshadow the physical violation you inflicted and the psychological and emotional trauma that flows from the derogation of the victim's rights and sense of security. This is exemplified by the fact that for days, Ms. Taylor did not want to believe that you, as a perceived friend and the partner of her good friend, did this to her. Negating the free agreement of another by deception to participate in sexual activity is insidious. To negate free agreement over protest and by restraint is callous. Both forms of conduct, together with your subsequent conduct, display a real lack of empathy for your victim. Ms. Taylor read her victim impact statement in court. I repeat, as I said on the plea, I do not like to use the word victim in relation to Ms. Taylor. It is clear that she has found her own voice. It was a heartfelt and eloquent, detailed account of the trauma she continues to feel to 23 months after the crimes. The changes to her life have been seismic. A wise judge once observed that the rehabilitation of the survivor of sexual crimes is often harder to achieve than that of the offender. Ms. Taylor's demonstrated courage is, hopefully, a positive sign that she is on the path to recovery. I've already said, and I say again, that I commend Ms. Taylor for her real integrity and courage in coming forward in person, in court, giving evidence, and then throughout the sentencing process. Mr. Hallows, Senior Counsel, submitted on your behalf that overall I should assess the objective gravity of your offending as falling below the mid-level. Mr. McWilliams, prosecuting, submitted that the second offence was mid-level and the first offence was not far behind. I have already referred to the factors which I consider inform the seriousness of your offending. The offence of rape can be committed in many different ways and in many different circumstances, evidenced at least in part by the fact that the prosecution could not supply any comparable cases. It goes without saying that your offending is very serious and your moral culpability is very high. Your offending must be met by general deterrence, denunciation, and just punishment. In summary, this analysis means that you must be sentenced to a term of imprisonment involving a head sentence and a non-parole period. I turn now to your personal circumstances. You are now 23 years old, being born on 25 September 2002. You were 21 years old at the time of your offending. You are the youngest of three siblings. Your family has strong ties to the AFL and to the media, which has brought a great deal of media attention to your family throughout your life and during this trial. You had a private school education, completing VCE during COVID. Like many young people in your cohort, you felt the isolation of the extended lockdowns. You displayed talent as a young footballer, but the COVID lockdowns and bans on sport extinguished your professional AFL prospects. You commenced a business degree at Monash University and worked through your degree. You then obtained a job in player management in 2021. You gave up work after you were charged as you were unable to obtain a working with children check because of the charges. I accept that your time on bail since 14 June 2024 kept you largely housebound and very socially isolated as you dealt with your mental health and the fear of being publicly exposed ahead of your trial. A number of character witnesses gave uncontested evidence of your good character at your trial, and several more provided character references at the plea. You are described in the references as a respectful and considerate young man. Dr. Jacqueline Rakov, forensic psychiatrist, provided five reports. In her first report, before charges were laid, Dr. Rakov noted that you suffered from depression and that you had experienced suicidal thoughts in childhood. Dr. Rakov noted that as a result of your arrest and charges, you suffered an acute stress reaction. Dr. Rakov reports that you have had recurrent suicidal thoughts through mid-2024, specifically related to the fear of public exposure. In her second and fourth reports, Dr. Rakov focused on your increased suicidality, her diagnosis of major depressive disorder, and your two bouts in hospital for depression and suicidality. In her report of 25 March 2024, Dr. Rakov notes a number of stressors were present in your early years. There was relentless media interest in your parents and particularly your father's sporting career, which trickled down into interest in you and your brother's football abilities. You often felt inadequate when compared to your brothers. You have at times growing up thought of suicide. Your football aspirations came to nothing with the isolation and cancellation of school sport in the crucial years leading up to the draft. Dr. Ong considers that you suffer from a recurrent major depressive disorder with passive persistent suicidality. Sentencing submissions. Both parties submit that a term of imprisonment is the only appropriate sentence. Mr. Hallows, SC, with Mr. Anderson, who appeared on your behalf throughout the trial and plea, submitted that the following factors should operate to mitigate your sentence. First, your offending was unplanned in the sense that it was opportunistic. Second, your young age at the time of the offending and still now means that the sentencing principles relating to youthful offenders must be given full weight. Third, Verdon's principles 5 and 6 apply in this case. Fourth, the delay, as it was characterised, in the resolution of this case enlivens the principles enunciated in the Queen and Merritt, Pigott and Ferrari. Fifth, you have suffered extracurial punishment. Sixth, your prospects of rehabilitation should be viewed as excellent, with your family's strong pro-social support, your previous good character, your strong work history and your youth providing a sound basis for your rehabilitation. And seventh, I was provided with a number of cases for comparison. I have read them, but in the end I must not be overly influenced by the results in other cases. I must formulate a sentence which is appropriate to the circumstances of this case, taking into account the matters personal to you so far as I can. Mr. McWilliams, who appeared for the Crown, submitted that the only appropriate sentence is a term of imprisonment with a head sentence and a non-parole period. The Crown concedes the following matters in mitigation of your sentence. First, the principles relating to youth. Second, the operation of Verdon's limbs 5 and 6. And third, that you were a person of good character prior to the offending. Otherwise, Mr. McWilliams submitted that the objective gravity of your offending called for the imposition of a sentence of imprisonment appropriate to your crimes. My analysis. I consider that for sentencing purposes, you are still a young offender. Moreover, you have no prior convictions or matters outstanding. The courts have long recognised that an offender's youth should mitigate their sentence. The courts recognise that through their immaturity, young offenders may make immature decisions and act rashly on them. They may, and I quote, lack the degree of insight, judgment and self-control that is possessed by an adult, close quote. They may not fully appreciate the nature, seriousness and consequences of their criminal conduct. And I refer to Mills and as a party. Then, courts presume and encourage the rehabilitation of young offenders. The effective rehabilitation of a young offender protects the community from further offending. The third aspect of this principle is of the undesirability of exposing young offenders to the effect of incarceration in the adult prison system. This goes without saying. Of course, the Court of Appeal also observes that in some instances, the seriousness of a young person's offending means that the mitigating factors that I've set out must take something of a back seat. Your offending is very serious, but I will still take these matters into account to the extent that I may. Your prospects of rehabilitation must be considered very good. You have the strong support of a good pro-social family. You have had the benefit of a good education, including a tertiary education, good initial experience in the workforce, and you have no prior convictions or drug or alcohol dependence issues. You have, as I say, unwavering family support. Your counsel submitted that your prospects of rehabilitation, as I say, are excellent. I cannot elevate my assessment to that level. Whilst you have no prior convictions, and you have not offended further and have no matters outstanding, you've demonstrated no remorse and no insight into any aspect of your wrongdoing. Not the rapes, not altering the Uber receipt, or your later conduct towards Anthony, or of course, your conduct towards Samantha. Successful rehabilitation requires both reform and remorse. Whilst I'm satisfied that the presumption of rehabilitation applies because of your young age, and that the static factors I've outlined apply to make your prospects very good, a question remains whilst you do not accept the fact of or the wrongfulness of your actions. In my view, there is little work for specific deterrence in the sentencing consideration. Mr. McWilliams submitted that the nature of your offending calls for a measure of specific deterrence. Whilst I consider that it must be taken into account in the mix of sentencing consideration, I do not consider that it needs to be expressly delineated or elevated in your circumstances. Extracurial punishment is where you are punished over and above the sentence that I impose. In this case, it is submitted that you have lost your career, opportunity in player contract management, and secondly, from the intense media scrutiny in this case. It appears that you worked in player management for 2 to 3 years part-time. I was not provided with any real details of your work. Your previous employer, Mr. Lenton, states in his reference that your return to this field is impossible. But without more, it is difficult to give this aspect much weight in mitigation. I will, however, accept, in addition to the other burdens you are currently carrying, that you will not be able to see past this blow for some time, and it will add to your depressed and anxious state. As I have said, you have been subject to intense media scrutiny relating to the trial, and especially from the time the non-publication order was lifted after verdict. To my observation, the media reporting of the facts of the case has been scrupulously objective and fair and in accordance with the order whilst it was in place. The principle of open courts should be permitted to operate as widely as possible. I accept, however, that in this case, the media scrutiny has gone beyond you, to your parents and to your siblings. I accept that you feel very deep shame for this. The reports of Dr. Rakov and Dr. Ong make it clear that your shame significantly contributes to your major depressive disorder. This is a separate consideration, the operation of what is known as the Verdon's principles. I will consider the effect of your depression and so the shame you feel as a mitigating factor next. The Verdon's principles are principles of law which take account of an offender's mental health to mitigate, that is to lessen, an offender's sentence. It is agreed that limbs 5 and 6 have been established in this case, and they are as follows. The existence of the condition at the date of sentencing or its foreseeable recurrence may mean that a given sentence will weigh more heavily on the offender than it would on a person in normal health. And where there is a serious risk of imprisonment having a significant adverse effect on the offender's mental health, this will be a factor tending to mitigate punishment. The condition here is your recurrent major depressive disorder. Your feelings of shame, anxiety and suicidality all contribute to the diagnosis of major depressive disorder. Mr. McWilliams agrees that the two limbs apply in your case. I will take the two limbs of Verdon's into account in the formulation and reduction of your sentence. Mr. Hallows submitted that the delay between charging and trial has exacerbated your anxiety and depression. You have lived under the uncertainty of these proceedings for 17 months and for a little under 2 years since the offence has occurred, that is 17 months since charge. I accept that you've been depressed and anxious over this time, as Dr. Rakov and Dr. Ong have reported. I accept the authority of Merritt Pickett and Ferrari speaks of delay as a powerful mitigatory factor, but the delay to which the Court of Appeal was referring to in that case was 5 years between the commission of the offence and sentencing. The delay in that case was labelled inordinate. The same cannot be said here. Nevertheless, I will give it some slight weight in the sentence consideration for the effect time has had on your mental health. In the end, as I've already discussed, it is the gravity of your offending, the denunciation of your conduct on behalf of the community, and just punishment which must dominate the sentencing consideration. The law requires that when sentencing for multiple offences, I must not simply impose sentences and add them together. Rather, I must ensure that the overall sentence is not crushing. In this case, I have moderated the period of accumulation, that is, adding sentences together, to take this principle into account. I consider that the matters raised in mitigation justify such a course. Accordingly, I am going to impose the following sentences. On charge one, the charge of rape, you are convicted and sentenced to 4 years and 6 months imprisonment. On charge two, the second charge of rape, you are convicted and sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. Charge two is the base sentence. I order that 14 months of the sentence on charge one be accumulated on charge two. That reaches a total effective sentence of 6 years and 2 months. I order that you serve a non-parole period of 3 years and 3 months before you are eligible for parole. I determine the period of 12 days pre-sentence detention, excluding today, reckoned as already served. The sentence for each charge is set below the standard sentence for the offence of rape. I have taken the standard sentence into account. After my consideration of the whole of the circumstances that I'm permitted to consider, I consider the sentences I have imposed serve the course of justice. Moreover, I have imposed a non-parole period which is 53% of the total effective sentence. I have done so as I again consider, having regard to the factors that I am permitted to consider, that it is in the interests of justice to do so, especially to achieve the purpose of rehabilitation, see as a party, and in consideration of your mental health. I consider it important to repeat an observation I made at the plea hearing. The setting of a non-parole period does not guarantee your release date. That will be a matter for the parole board. The law requires me to sentence you as if you will serve every day of the head sentence. Parole can be difficult to achieve and onerous to maintain once granted. Any breach of parole would see you return to prison to serve the balance of the sentence. Mr. McWilliams, are there any other matters?
No.
Mr. Hallows, are there any other matters?
No.
Ms. Taylor, thank you for your attendance again at court today. Mr. Silvani, I will now cut the link. We'll make arrangements to speak to Mr. Silvani through other means.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'll adjourn now.
Silence will stand. This honourable court stands adjourned. Signed off.